you know, let's be clear, they're supposed to focus on infectious diseases, and they're doing testing, and they're doing eviction moratoria, and they're doing God knows what else. It's no surprise to me that they missed the most important questions here. It's because they're not working on infectious diseases anymore.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. I've got a great guest with me here today. That's Kent Lassman. He's the president of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a free market think tank here in Washington, D.C. Kent, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. This is going to be a good time.
Yeah, look, so I'm really excited to talk to you because of the work that CEI does is based on the things that I'm passionate about, you know, free markets, deregulation, getting the engine of economic growth in a capitalist society going in a time that feels like it's so constantly encroaching in bureaucracy and the size of government just goes up and up and up. But I guess just to start at a very zoomed out level, when you think of the last year in terms of the COVID pandemic and everything that's been ushered through it, is it a bleak time in your mind in terms of the expansions of government power and role in the economy that we've seen?
I think it's too easy to say it's, you know, all the sunny optimism about the great deregulatory strides that we saw, or about the massive expansion, particularly with governors and the lockdown effects and just the petty intrusions into life. It really is a mixed bag. Even among the worst of the bad growth of government and the intrusions into our lives, I do think there are some really important silver linings, and those silver linings, they help me wake up with a smile each day.
Yeah, so let's talk about those, in that I was just reading about this the other day in a Wall Street Journal article, but there are all these ways in which the COVID pandemic really shined a light on how overregulated our society is. I know here where I live in Arlington, Virginia, they wanted to do outdoor dining because it's safer because of COVID. And they had to all get exemptions from city ordinances that didn't let restaurants have tables outside without a special permit and fines and all sorts of things. So maybe just can you tell us about a couple examples of these ways where the pandemic has shined a light on rules that never should have existed at all?
These never needed rules is what we call them here at CEI. We've tracked, documented, tried to get our arms around more than 800 of them across the country have either been suspended or permanently repealed in the last year. And they came in waves. In the very beginning, when there was not much information, we saw them primarily in areas like education. There are important, so-called important rules about how many administrators had to be present for loading children on buses. Well, if the buses were being used to deliver food but not children to the school because the schools were shut down, was the rule needed, right? How do you go about suspending that or setting that aside? They were in education, they were in transportation, and oftentimes they were in manufacturing. As we moved into the summer and throughout the year, we started seeing them pop up in all parts of life. So restaurants, food delivery, a lot of restaurants, for example, started offering to-go items so that they were mini groceries. It allowed them to stay open as a essential service, like grocery stores would stay open. Well, if you go into a restaurant and they have a rack with prepared foods, then sell it that way. I think we saw bipartisan recognition. If governors of both major political parties identified these things as just standing in the way. We saw this crop up from the grassroots, which I think is tremendously important for people to say, like, what the heck is going on? I can't build a picnic table to serve, you know, drinks on the front sidewalk of my restaurant because of building codes or whatnot. And we saw them in ways that are visceral to people that really matter. And they're in health area. So changes at the FDA testing, as well as one of the first sets of rules to drop in New York, typically a heavily regulated state, very slow to peel things back, was the construction of new temporary facilities to do testing and to house people who were ill. So you might remember the Javits Center had like a pop-up hospital.
Mm-hmm.
They needed all sorts of regulatory repeals to put that in, because building or constructing health facilities have a whole special set of regulations, most of which, some might have some safety reasons, most of which were just not needed.
Yeah, and that's what interests me, is the idea of emergency waivers for regulations, because it seems this is what happened a lot of times. They were waived, these regulations were waived because of an emergency. And any regulation that exists is supposed to exist for health and safety. So I guess I'm just kind of confused by the entire concept. If in the worst times, in the most dangerous times, you can actually waive these rules and they're not helpful, why would you ever have them at all? The idea of an emergency waiver for regulation seems to me entirely backwards.
You and me both. And I think there's an important distinction to make here. And it's easily blurred when we talk about the way government is structured and the way these regulatory systems just spit out rule after rule. To regulate, that verb in English is a homophone. It means two different things. On one hand, it means to make regular, like to organize. So we're going to line people up 1 through 10, or alphabetically would be to regulate the kids in the kindergarten classroom, right? Standard setting. Another is to control. That second meaning is to control things. And when it comes to health and safety regulation, we're talking about controlling. And we're saying, we're going to control the decision-making and the risk assessment on behalf of you, because we think we can do it better, or that you're not capable of collecting the information or whatnot. This is the logic behind licensing and all sorts of regulation. When the risk is highest and information is lowest, that is when you would imagine people would have the hardest time making good decisions. And yet that's when we see the repeals. And it really put to the lie that government can overcome this knowledge problem, which we in the free market community have long known about and talked about. But suddenly it became apparent not only to regulators and elected officials that were feeling pressure from constituents, but also to those constituents. People were saying, well, I'm not gonna trust the school board. I'm gonna make the decision for what makes sense for my family about whether or not my child should be in a school environment.
Yeah, and I guess that raises the question, what is the impetus or the driving force? Like, how did we end up so drowned in regulations without most people even realizing it? Like, how did it come to be that there even are rules saying restaurants can't put a picnic table outside? Or how did we get here before the pandemic?
It's like a lot of things in life. It's out of sight and out of mind. So most regulation that exists on our lives doesn't affect you, right? So there's distributed costs. And if you're not paying attention to it, or you're not conscious of it, or if the effect on you is minuscule in the aggregate for your life, it only affects you once a year, you're not really going to do much about it. It's reasonable for you not to devote time and energy to it. So it accretes slowly because of these out of sight, out of mind, distributed effects. It's also the case that the way our administrative law is constructed, and here I mean the foundational laws about the process, going back to the New Deal, going back to the 1930s, the APA, it's almost like a self-perpetuating machine. So one set of rules is put in place that begs the question, shall we adjust them or notch them up once? It does not allow for revisiting them, evaluating whether they're doing what they're supposed to do, and to repeal them is quite difficult. So the ratchet is all focused in one direction toward growth. And that growth, there's a bit of a public choice problem in that it suits our Article One branch of government. It suits the Congress to be able to have somebody else doing all this work, because they don't have to do it. And when they get a call from a constituent, they can say, oh, that wasn't me, that was the EPA. That wasn't me, that was the Department of Interior that took away your land. That wasn't me, that was, you know, someone else. And it makes it so they don't have to do as much work. And legislating is hard work. Rulemaking out of sight without democratic accountability is technical, but it's not nearly as politically difficult.
And that's an interesting point, but I guess a different side of this coin, what role does kind of crony capitalism or like interest groups and trade associations play in how some of these rules that don't make any sense from a consumer point of view come to become law?
This is the story. There's a wonderful article that many of your audience are familiar with. 1983, Bruce Yandel down at Clemson wrote this article about Baptists and bootleggers, right? And the idea is different interests could get together for the same objective. And he was writing about prohibition at the time, that Baptists did not want to see, they thought they could have a better state or more morality if people didn't drink on Sundays. And the bootleggers wanted to exclude competition. They wanted people to buy their moonshine instead of buying at a liquor store. Once private entities can look at government as a source of either privilege for themselves or a hindrance for their potential competition, it's game on. Everybody comes calling saying why they want some regulation put in place. So supermarkets would lobby against restaurants would argue and lobby against in-home kitchens. You see this in immigrant communities where maybe they're making like sopapillas or enchiladas or something just for their neighborhood. You can buy a meal as opposed to going to a restaurant and sitting down and having a meal served. You have this with three-tier systems. I mentioned alcohol distribution, but also automobiles and automobile dealers and direct sales from manufacturers. One, the dealers can argue, we need to be in the middle. You ought to regulate preventing direct sales. That's when you see these interest groups aligning, working with government to grow government. And it shouldn't be lost. Government is its own interest group. You know, so the agencies their own incentives to grow and accrete power to themselves.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And I have found it interesting. I think this is coming into very acute focus now with some of the kind of woke capitalism where you have CEOs punishing Republican states or pushing a very left-wing cultural agenda. But it is interesting to see the paradigm shift over time, because at some point, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, or back in the Reagan era or whatever, I mean, before I was born, but even more recently than that, you would have thought as CEOs and big business, that's the Republican allies. And then, you know, Democrats and big government, well, that's the allies of the working class and the working people. But it seems to me more and more that there's a realignment and that big business and big government are increasingly becoming allies, or maybe they've always been allies, but people are increasingly starting to realize it.
I think it's been this way for a long time with greater and lesser amounts of recognition. There's an important lesson. Whenever you see a regulation or a new business tax that is going to affect incumbents, when you see some part of that incumbent class turn and say, this will be okay, or even advocate for it, probably the classic example in contemporary dialogue in the last 6 months is my friends, I'm an avid consumer through Amazon, right? Wonderful business. It's done tremendous for commerce and people in the world and buyers and sellers. But when they offer $15 minimum wage to their own workers, it's an entirely different thing when they turn around the next day and say, and it ought to be a law. Because what they're saying is, we want to raise the costs on anyone who might commit this. And the most important constraint on those incumbents is not necessarily the other potential market entrants and players. 20 years ago, the biggest challenge to Microsoft was the federal government. The next biggest challenge was not Oracle or Sun or Netscape or any of these other companies. It was Google and Facebook and all the companies that were about to be invented, that were about to eat their lunch in the next decade. And the same holds today for whatever big company that you're talking about, whether it's transportation companies or e-commerce companies or whatever it is.
Yeah, I just always found this really interesting. You mentioned the $15 minimum wage. Well, that's one that's supported by Walmart. It's supported by Target. It's supported by Amazon. It's supported by McDonald's, all these companies. I get targeted ads from Facebook about why we need more tech regulation. And I don't dislike any of these companies. I agree with you that they've done many great things, but that always sets off a red flag for me.
Hey guys, Brad here cutting in to bring you a message from our friends over at the Chris Spangles Show in the We Are Libertarians podcast network. If you like my show, you should check theirs out.
Our goal at the Chris Spangles Show is to help you sound smarter while talking with your friends. If you struggle to understand politics, we explain it from an independent libertarian perspective with all of the irreverence modern politics deserves. We toss out the screaming heads and put people before political parties and give context to the news to make you think. I'm the host. I'm a 15-year veteran of politics and media, and this show is published every Saturday. It's part of the We Are Libertarians Network, and be sure to join Wall Plus for bonus podcasts, the complete archives, commercial-free shows, and more. Subscribe now at WeAreLibertarians.com.
Just the other day, and I wrote about this, Jeff Bezos and Amazon officially endorsed raising corporate taxes. That should be a red flag, I think, right? Because they know that they can weather the storm, but maybe some of their competitors can't. And they also know that corporate taxes in reality are mostly borne, economic research shows this clearly, by workers in lower wages and consumers in higher prices. So I guess, how do you grab progressives and shake them and say, listen, you're not actually helping the little guy when all your policy agenda is increasingly supported by big business, that's really at least the big business folks that have a lot of sway with the government?
I think we have to start, my experience has been, clearly, we're not doing enough of this or winning often enough on this question. But I think you have to start the conversation a step before the concrete policy, before the logical argument, before the evidence about, you're exactly right about tax incidents and the way these things kind of flow through and the equity arguments. I think we have to start a step before and say to our neighbor or our progressive friend or the person across the aisle or whomever it might be, what is it you're trying to achieve? Because I will tell you what I'm trying to achieve, and I think there's significant overlap. And if what you're trying to achieve is more economic security, better educational opportunities, all of these kind of broad stroke things, not just for Americans or people in the world, but for people who could benefit most, I can agree with that. Let me show you an alternative path to government subsidies or to price floors on labor or on raising taxes and distributing welfare transfers. And that alternative method, then you can get into the model of why capitalism works, why free exchange and cooperation is superior to coercion and redistribution. And then you can talk about the policies. But you have to start with that shared value. And if you can't say and I think too many of my friends and allies and people in our regular professional spheres have trouble saying, I care about poor people. That ought to be the first thing we say. I care about people who are like me. I care about people who are unlike me. I care about people who have the same preferences, people who do wildly different things than me. And I care about their interests. And I want them to do well because I want to do my thing. And I think that's where we have to start this conversation. It is not the case that progressives or liberals or Democrats or however we categorize each other, that they're unaware of government failure, that they're unaware that these systems that we have in place don't work. No one can look with a straight face at today's incarceration. Nobody can look at the way tax incidence flows through our economy and says, this is a good system for collecting and raising revenue. We don't have a good system. So if you start with that shared value, then you talk about different alternative paths. And the one path we've been trying for almost 100 years doesn't work. So I think we're on really good footing for that second step of the conversation.
I love the framing. I will say this though, I don't know how to reach some of my peers and some people where they look at these government failures, right? And they see the need to have better champions and more government and more investment. They look at our failed healthcare system where it's really just absolutely horrendous system. It is not a free market. And they say that the solution is that we need more government. They need to take it completely over. And this time we'll put our guys in charge. We'll put AOC instead of Joe Biden. And how do you get people out of the mindset that they just need to try harder or invest more? I mean, this is literally what they say about, they say, well, we have to fix Obamacare or we have to expand on Obamacare. And it's like, well, you told us it would fix it then.
I think you're a little bit further along the line of the conversation and you can say, so honest questions help here. So what you're talking about in that case is something that looks like, you know, interest in more of this or fixing it means Medicare for all, right? It's a universal system. Well, that means that's what the VA system is. You don't have to look far to see not just scandal, but scandalous delivery of services. Months, if not years, of waiting for basic services. People that their records are, you know, I mean, on and on and on, right? So if what you're asking for is more, we've tried that. We've piloted it with tens of thousands of people. It has failed. What you're talking about is more. That's how we do primary education in this country. And it does not work. We put our guys in charge, and they're called Randy Weingarten in the teachers' unions. Right, our guys are failing on that. And the brightest places, the brightest lights of success in primary education right now are in alternative education sources. And you know the story, right? I mean, it's choice options, it's voucher systems, it's Catholic schools, it's KIPP Academy, all of these menu of experiments that we've been doing now for 30 years, some of them much longer, but primarily for the last 25 to 30 years. So I think you have to push people to face facts of what you're talking about has been tried. And it's not just Venezuela or the Soviet Union, and Gen Z is pretty far away from the Soviet Union, but you're not so far away from genuine scandals at the Veterans Affairs Administration.
Right, and we've touched on this issue a couple times, but I wanna go a little deeper on it. Because I know it's so central to the stuff that you guys have done at CEI, but I think I hate when we get trapped in the healthcare paradigm of socialists or progressives who want more government, and then conservatives, libertarians, you have to defend the status quo, because the status quo is that's the free market capitalist answer. No, it is not. But that is the framing, unfortunately, oftentimes, even though we spend so much money on healthcare from the government, so much of it is government provided, all of it's regulated and crony. But one thing that has happened is tons of deregulation in healthcare, how healthcare can be delivered because of the COVID pandemic. So maybe you could just talk about that and see some of the great results we've seen from that and what it suggests about a free market path to real improvements.
I think the seeds of this conversation are exactly in the way you described it. On one hand, it's a discussion of provision of service, the government model. On the other hand, it's what gets thrown in your face or what you often hear is like, well, we already have a free market system, right? In fact, we don't. And we need to be talking about it in terms of who gets to make the decision. So it's not who gets to provide the service. It's who gets to make the decision about the consumption good. And when you empower individuals and families, that means by dint of empowering individuals or families, you are empowering a market to emerge. And that's where the COVID experience is really instructive. Markets have emerged for licensed practitioners, nurses, nurse practitioners, doctors, et cetera, to practice across state lines. Markets have emerged because we needed them so dire, the need was so dire for consultations not to have restrictions about being in person, and consultations could be like we're doing today across technology. That sort of shift from, instead of talking about the provision of service, which gets you trapped in not a free market conversation, but a who can be more or less technocratic in your regulatory scheme. But in the conversation about who ought to be making these decisions, right? And there are plenty of decisions about health that I don't make on my own. I seek out advice, I get counsel, I have trusted doctors. You know, my wife and I talk about them. There's all sorts of things that go into that. But it should not be a decision of someone who's designing the application form at HHS, at the Department of Health and Human Services, about whether or not my test is something that should be covered by government insurance. It should be over here with the individual, the household, the family, or even with private associative groups, right? So you could have, it's easy to imagine that, a group of friends who all love comic books get together and do for their healthcare what we saw crop up famously with investor clubs. People got together every Tuesday and talked about what stocks to buy. You can do the same thing with whether or not it's a good idea to have LASIK, or whether or not it's a good idea to have a herniated disc repaired or not. What are the risks? You could have the same thing with private association groups like unions or the Kiwanis Club, Boy Scouts, or whatever association you're of. You get your health advice elsewhere than from the government.
Yeah, and that is a really interesting point. One other aspect of the health question and the government question that I feel like the COVID pandemic has really exposed is the way that, for example, the CDC and the FDA combined to block private testing kits. And then the way the government really got out of the way to allow the COVID vaccines to arrive in such record time. To what extent does that show you how warped the system was before the pandemic?
Well, this is one of those silver linings that I was talking about. Because so many people were intensely cared and were paying attention. The debacle 14 months ago, 15 months ago now, at the CDC, between private labs, the CDC and the FDA, and in this sort of Keystone Cops, like I'm in charge, you're in charge, I'm not going to make the call. The delays that came, everyone was paying attention. Everyone was watching. It was literally life or death, right? People, they cared as much as they're going to care about three-letter regulatory agencies. That very high-profile government failure, I think, is horrible. I do not want to say this is a good thing. That is not at all what I mean. When it gets taken out of context, you have this clip to know that that's not what I meant. But there is a silver lining, and that is people see how the FDA may be the only government agency outside of the United States military that is designed to help people die, right? The precaution that they put in place to disallow innovation and disallow private uses and testing causes people to die. And we're not talking about one very heart-wrenching story of a very empathetic character. We're talking about tens of thousands and now hundreds of thousands of Americans who have died as a result of not catching the growth of this pandemic early, when things really could have changed the trajectory of its spread through the society. And I think that silver lining is it does not make it easy to do FDA reform or to change the mandate of the CDC, which, you know, let's be clear, they're supposed to focus on infectious diseases, and they're doing testing, and they're doing eviction moratoria, and they're doing God knows what else. It's no surprise to me that they missed the most important questions here. It's because they're not working on infectious diseases anymore. They're doing everything but that. So I do think there's a silver lining here in that if we can motivate people from their disgust to action, there's an opportunity to reshape those primary health regulatory agencies.
Yeah, and hopefully people, I think, will see that that's going on, and we'll see the myriad ways in which big government over the last year has really further discredited itself. I think the COVID pandemic to date is best told as a comedy of government error after government error after government error after government miscalculation, all the while those same government officials get on TV and blame the American people for not doing the right thing enough or not following the orders correctly or closely enough. And in many cases, the real blame lied with the orders themselves coming down from the centralized power. But I think that's a good place to leave the kind of serious conversation. People can check out the links that will be in the show description to find out more about what you and CEI do on all of these issues. So I think we could go to the final and most important part of this podcast, Kent. I warned you before the show. You have to have a hot food take. Lay it on us.
Hot food take from Kent Lastman is that in every way, every single day, tea is superior to coffee.
Oh, no.
Yeah,
it's true. I love iced coffee.
I'm nope, a huge sorry, buddy.
Iced coffee guy. What kind of tea? How do you drink the tea?
Oh, it depends on the situation. There's green tea, black teas, there's you know, you get the white tip tea, iced tea. If you're in the South and you're sitting on a porch, you can have sweet tea. Tea is superior in every way.
I've just never gotten into it, but I really should because I need to reduce my caffeine intake. It's probably at a lethal level. So maybe I will have to get a pack of tea and try it out. Kent, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me, Brad.